The ex-prisoner and for society. Finding a job is difficult, and without a job, it is all too easy to fall back on crime as a way to support yourself. In fact, two-thirds of those released from prison are arrested for new crimes within 3 years. But there is an organization in Charlotte that helps former inmates reintegrate back into society. The Center for Community Transitions begins their work years before these inmates are officially released. At the moment, they're working with 30 incarcerated women with 3 years or less remaining on their sentence. They're helping advance their education and to find jobs for these folks. Myra Clark is executive director of the Center for Community Transitions, and Eric Ortega is program director of the Center's LifeWorks program. They're both with us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you.
Morning.
Great to be here.
Paul Stroud, is it? I should have asked you before we started. Paul Stroud or Stroud?
Stroud,
I got it right. Paul Stroud is one of the center's former clients. He served a prison sentence for selling drugs. After his release, he took part in the center's employment readiness classes and has found a job, which we'll talk about. And he also is with us in our Spirit Square studio this morning. Welcome.
Thanks to have you here.
Just to give listeners an idea of the scope of the problem and the need for what you do, each week, more than 100 people who have completed jail sentences find their way to Mecklenburg County every week. How many of those 100 people come here equipped to be a productive, law-abiding citizen after spending time in jail?
Well, I want to clarify something. There's a distinction between jail and prison.
Okay.
And the hundred or so plus that come out every week are coming out of prison. So they've served sentences 2 years or longer.
Mm-hmm.
And the jail downtown, they may have a lot of people who go in and out. So they go in, get arrested, maybe spend one night, get out. And they also have people for long periods of time awaiting trial. So they sometimes report or have reported as many as 30,000 people going in and out of jail, and some of them the same folks.
But it would seem to me that the folks coming out of prison after having spent a long time in prison,
right.
2-3 years is probably a short time, but there are people getting out who have served longer sentences than that. And I mentioned this before we started. I'm reading a wonderful New York Times Sunday Magazine article about this, about the California system, because they had that three strikes law in the 90s that put scads of people in prison for really what were called serious crimes, but they were really minor. One guy was in prison because his third offense was stealing a pair of white socks.
Right.
So they put him in jail for life. Well, they've had a reversal of that in California, and they're letting people out after 10, 20 years in prison. And these people are bewildered by what they're finding on the outside. Because think about how the world has changed.
Exactly.
In 20 years. But it's not only that. It's that life in prison, evidently, I've never been there, is incredibly regimented. They tell you when to eat, when to sleep, when to do this, when to do that. And some people report that when they get out, they forget to eat because it's not mealtime. No one has said, come eat.
Even the time you eat is different. In prison, you eat around 5 o'clock in the morning. That's breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And when you come home, so you're up at 5 o'clock in the morning while everyone else is still sleeping because you want breakfast. That's the time you get hungry because your body becomes accustomed to it.
Right.
It's a culture change. And that it's traumatic for many to come home from prison and say, I've lived this life where I was making only maybe 100 decisions a day because someone was deciding what I was going to wear, what I was going to eat, where I was going to be. And the next day when you're released, you have to make 2,000 decisions in an hour,
right?
About where you're going to go, what you're going to eat, what you're going to watch.
And prison is organized, and society is not.
No,
this
a long is
true.
Shot.
So, both Eric, you spent some time in prison, and Paul, how long were you in
jail time as well as prison time? I did almost 4 years.
Okay, so did you experience any of these problems when you got out?
Definitely. I just getting out. I also had the idea of just not really eating much at all. It was just being somewhat institutionalized is a word that is very common vernacular for the prison and the jails. But I didn't really want to do anything. I stuck to my normal routine, which was eating certain foods, like eating a lot of junk food, even like just not watching TV, because I abstained from watching TV really because it was just something that I really didn't enjoy. And when I got out, I found myself still reading books most of the time, just mm-hmm. a lot of the time, as well as doing like Bible study a lot to compensate and to really to allow myself to have something to do besides. So I just basically wanted to be isolated more so to myself in my shell, yes.
So these folks getting out have led very regimented lives. Suddenly they're in society, which is just chaos in their eyes, because we can do anything we want to anytime we want to, and you have to make a million decisions a day. Many of them confront new technologies that they simply don't understand because they weren't brought along into those technologies as they were developing. Suddenly they're hit with the fact that you don't use a token on a bus anymore. You use this card that has a chip in it someplace. I mean, it's bewildering. And then they have to find a place to live. They have to find clothes to wear. Many times they're released from prison with no money to speak of, and they're expected to report to a parole officer and find their way to that parole officer. They don't know how to use the transportation system. They don't have a job.
And they have to pay for supervision of that parole officer.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it sounds like we're setting these people up for failure, are we?
It definitely could seem that way. And for many, it is. It's first, you deal with the trauma of culture shock. Then you deal with the expectations of finding a place to live, which is almost impossible because
you have a record.
You have a record.
Exactly.
And you also need a job to pay rent.
You have a record.
So it's one of those, what comes first, chicken before or the egg, right? Do I get a job first to get housing, or do I get housing to be able to find a job? When you're staying in the streets, it's hard to really focus on, let me make myself presentable so I could find a job. You're thinking about where I'm going to lay my head the next day.
Yeah.
You know, in Charlotte, when it's nice outside, you see a lot of people stay outside. But when it gets cold,
yeah.
They're really struggling with that.
So the Center for Community Transitions has been helping with this problem. How long have you been doing this?
Since 1974.
Why don't we know about you? I swear to you, until I saw my friend Carolyn Mintz at an event the other night, I had never heard of the Center for Community Transitions. Why?
Well, we're just quietly helping people put their lives back together as best they can.
Why so quietly? Obviously, the need is great.
Yeah, well,
Myra has a phrase. We're the best kept secret in Charlotte.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, obviously.
Yeah. Well, we would like for people to know more about us, but, you know, it's one of those questions we have about. We want people to know about us, but we also want our clients to be able to put their lives back together without being under microscope
quietly.
For every action that they take.
Right. So there are a number of things that you do. I mentioned one of them in the opening, but let me see here. You work with families
yes.
whose loved ones are incarcerated in a program called Families Doing Time. It's called that because?
The families pick the name because they feel like they're doing a prison sentence while their loved one is incarcerated.
Because in a way they are?
In a way they are. They're very isolated. Many lose friendships. Their finances change, the family dynamics change. Children who were able to be children now have to be adults to help out in the family. A lot of things change for families when a family member goes to prison. There's a lot of shame and guilt that are surrounded by that that's not of their own doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why one of the programs we have in our family program is a program called EQUIP, Empowering Kids with Incarcerated Parents, which is a school-based support group for children who have a parent who's incarcerated.
As soon as we started talking about families doing time, Paul, you nodded your head in recognition of families having to deal with this as well as the inmate.
Right. Just so many relatives and seeing. So being in a place where you are just curious to know if, you know, is the cycle going to even stop? Because my family, my relatives, they were gone, and I just really was at a place where I didn't understand it. And I guess it's almost like a domino effect to a certain extent, because everybody's getting in that type of lifestyle, and it's kind of easy to gear towards it, I guess.
Let me make sure I understand you. Are you speaking about your experience as an inmate being taken away from your family, or are you speaking because somebody in your family prior to your being incarcerated was taken away from you?
Actually, both. To be honest, I believe that that really makes an effect on your life,
mm-hmm.
because being exposed to that lifestyle and then it almost draws you to it, because a lot of times if you don't know something, you really don't if you're unaware of something, you really won't even move towards it or shift towards what it is. So to actually have been exposed to that, I believe that also plays a big component in if a person will be exposed to prison or to the jails or anything whatsoever, just because who they're around and what they have been involved with, and the people that have been taken away out of their life due to the incarceration takeaway.
That is one of the reasons you have this program for families, particularly for the children in these programs, and particularly for the male children in these programs, because most of the people going to jail are men. And for the male children, you have removed a role model, and you have removed their father or their
mother,
or and they seem to gravitate toward others who get themselves into trouble because there's nobody to say, hey, don't do that. Is that part of the problem?
I think that's some of it. I think some of it is we don't know how to talk to children about difficult issues. Mm-hmm. And so talking with children about having a parent in prison, many families tell the child that the parent's working out of town. Mm-hmm. They tell the child that the parent's in school. They give some kind of response that makes it not what it is. And then the child, when they find out, sometimes feel like that adult's not trustworthy because they haven't told them the honest truth about that. And I think children start acting out. They kind of understand things and they start acting out, or they withdraw. They do one of those antisocial behaviors probably. And they end up not doing well in school. And it just starts a cycle of expectation of their behavior. And so one of the things we find in our support groups for kids is that teachers are reporting that the children are behaving better in the classroom, that they're getting along better with others. So we're finding that it's calming them down to be more available to learn in the classroom.
There's also a program at the Center for Community Transitions called LifeWorks, which I understand evolved from the service to help men leaving prison to find employment and housing. Eric, I think you're in charge of that, so talk about that.
Yeah, the LifeWorks program is the oldest program of the agency, and what we do there is, it's something Paul mentioned before. If we provide people the opportunity to look at their life and shift the way they want to be, shift their beliefs to match what they want in their life now. If an individual has always known a life of a hustler, we want to show them how to hustle the right way. So we do this through employment readiness, because we know that employment readiness, finding a job, is essential to success. You need money. But you need money where it's sustainable and it's not going to get you in trouble. So we do offer a 2-week employment readiness class where we provide them the opportunity to look at their brand. Who do you want to be? What do you want to represent today? So we have 2 weeks of classes talking about their brand and what their brand means to them in regards to how you meet people. We really want them to shift their whole self to match with what they want in their life moving forward.
We'll talk more about that and about the other programs at the Center for Community Transitions and hear both Eric and Paul's individual stories of life in and out and coming back into society in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NS2 presenting New Year's Eve with the Avett Brothers December 31st at Greensboro Coliseum. Tickets available tomorrow, 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster.com. More info at GreensboroColiseum.com. And Alexander Youth Network, behavioral health care that's helping kids go good. Details about therapy programs for kids at AlexanderYouthNetwork.org. Well, Charlotte and other municipalities have been developing greenways for years, and now the city and county are working to connect them all together. If they're successful, we're going to have one interconnected greenway that stretches from Pineville through uptown to UNC Charlotte, and then out to the Cabarrus County line. It's going to be a seamless 26-mile stretch of trails with potential for economic growth, and we'll hear all about it tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, GOP presidential candidates gather in California for the second debate, morning after analysis of how the candidates fared and implications for the Republican nomination for president.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Center for Community Transitions. It's an organization that's been involved in helping inmates return to society in this area for about 40 years, if I'm not mistaken. Did you say 40?
Yeah.
Myra Clark is the executive director. Eric Ortega is the program director of one of their programs called Life Works. And Paul Stroud's a former client at the Center for Community Transitions. You've been in this field, Myra, for 30 years. Eric, you've been working here and in New York with people with criminal records for about 21 years. For those of us who don't know these people that you work with, who are the people that we have put in prison and why are they there?
Great question. Well, one group of people that we've put in prison are folks who used to receive mental health treatment at mental health facilities. And now we know that we're seeing more and more that some of those folks are filling up the prisons. And so that's one of the reasons for the growth. I also think that we've disproportionately, as we've seen in the news, put people of color in prisons and jails. And I think it's also disproportionately people who've grown up in poverty. Our board chair likes to say that it's, or someone else I've heard say too, that it's kind of a zip code lottery. So there are zip codes that if you have the resources, you can keep your family member out of prison. But there are other zip codes where the resources are just not available.
Did either of you grow up in poverty?
Yeah, I grew up poor. P-O. I couldn't afford the O-R in New York. So, yeah, I grew up in poverty.
Paul? Yes, I am actually from a gang-related neighborhood.
Hidden Valley.
Hidden Valley, mm-hmm. Yes. So Hidden Valley is a neighborhood of its own kind, okay. I will say. It may look suburban, but when the streetlights go off, you'll know it.
So we have put, as you said, a lot of poor people in prison. Why are they the ones committing crime? Are they committing crimes initially because they want to feed and house and clothe themselves, or because of some other reason?
I think there are a lot of crimes of survival, of people doing behaviors or being involved in crime to feed their families, to put a roof over their head and that kind of thing. I think there are some of that.
And although there's a very popular television show called Orange is the New Black that deals with women in prison, those people who don't have Netflix have never seen that show, including me, but you deal with women who are coming out of prison. Who are these women who are in prison? What have they done to get themselves there?
Again, a variety of things.
Okay.
There are quite a few women who were incarcerated because in North Carolina, there's no self-defense law about domestic violence. So there are quite a few women who were in prison because of domestic violence.
Because they have defended themselves?
Yes, or because they've murdered their abuser.
Mm-hmm. And we put them in prison.
Mm-hmm. And then there are also, you know, again, crimes of survival. And I mean, women, it used to be women were bad check writers and things like that. Well, that's changed considerably. So there are women who are now incarcerated who have committed the gamut of crimes, from bad check writing to murder.
Selling drugs.
So to speak. Selling drugs, embezzlement, property crimes, those kinds of things. So it's a variety of things that put people in prison.
So when you go to prison for these crimes, society tells itself that we put people in prison to punish them and supposedly to rehabilitate them. Does that happen in prison, rehabilitation?
I would say rehabilitation starts with self, within. There is not one person who rehabilitates in prison who does not initially take that first step. Because there are so many things which sidetrack you. You have the typical norms of hobbies and leisure activities that you can be involved in. So as far as anything that is really expands your realm of knowledge and your vision, it's not going to happen unless you take on a faith-based group, or unless you take on classes for your own personal knowledge.
And how many people do that in your experience?
I would say 2 out of 10.
Wow.
possibly even one.
So whether you take these classes and improve yourself while in prison or not, if your sentence is 10 years and you haven't done anything drastic while you're in prison, you're going to get out. Does the prison system in any way prepare these people for what they will confront when they do get out?
A small population does. I think it's really small. I think psychologically, there are programs while incarcerated that they can take, trades that
Are they voluntary programs?
Yeah, voluntary programs they can take to pick up a trade, to enhance their skill level and enhance their marketability. Psychologically, no. The impact of release to the psyche is so traumatic. I do not believe that both in New York or in North Carolina that the system really prepares them for that. Prepares them to face homelessness, difficulties finding a job.
Why don't we? This article I was reading in the New York Times talked about how, in California at least, because they are rapidly releasing people who were incarcerated during their Get Tough on Crime period, and now they've decided to change course on that, the inmate will find out sometimes hours before they're being released that they're being released. And suddenly the gate opens, they walk outside, they're given $200.
That's actually a lot.
That's a lot of money.
Well, they're given $200, and much of that goes back to the prison if they need a ride to the Greyhound bus station.
Oh.
And then they need to find their way to a parole officer in 48 hours, wherever they end up going. That doesn't sound like a lot of money to me. And they had no preparation for their release whatsoever because they didn't see it coming. Why are we doing this to people? Why are we doing this to ourselves?
Well, I will say there is some movement in doing a better job of preparing people for release. In North Carolina, they want when people are discharged from prison, they want them to have a place to go. And they can't go to the shelters. So they have to have a home plan and a place to go.
Mm-hmm.
There are, the parole probation folks are undergoing a different kind of training. So it's not just about supervision and our clients use is kind of caught you doing something bad, but more of a helping and let's think through what the next step might be. So there's more of that going on. I just think that it requires a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires a lot more once they're in the community, a lot more services, a lot more resources, particularly for housing and employment and job training and education.
Substance abuse treatment, mental health. The holistic approach of looking at an individual coming out is a necessity. We have made a lot of progress in the correction system in regards to looking at what does the person need, not just clothing or just a check. Here's a $40 check. I think in North Carolina they give them a $40 check.
$45.
Wow.
They could play some scratch-offs and maybe hit the lotto and get lucky there, but that might not happen for sure. But there is progress. One of the things that comes up, this is not a popular or a pretty subject. So there's not much funding in the community that says, well, you know what, we need more housing for individuals coming home.
But it costs $29,000 a year, I think, in North Carolina, somewhere in that neighborhood, to house a prisoner.
That's about right.
If it's fairly certain, and the statistics show, that if you don't get a job and you're having trouble supporting yourself after you get out of prison, you're going to go back. Isn't it cheaper to support organizations like yours and have a plethora of organizations like yours who give these people the guidance and the aid they need when they first get out to get them jobs, to teach them how to act in society, to help them reintegrate themselves into this chaos that we call society from a very regimented situation? Wouldn't we be saving money?
We would be saving money. We would be teaching people how to think differently and so therefore behaving differently. We would be doing a lot more to help that person reintegrate into our community as a law-abiding, productive member of society.
We have a social media question that we're posing this morning. Do you think society should do more to help ex-offenders rebuild their lives? You can let us know how you feel about that on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Paul, you served time for selling drugs. You grew up in Hidden Valley. You were a state champion basketball player.
Yes.
Why were you not able to parlay that into a successful life? How did you get sucked into selling drugs?
Well, it more so came just being a product of my neighborhood at the time. Coming into a agreement with those that I was in associations with that, you know, my basketball and my sports career became secondary. It was not as important to me as it should have been. I didn't weigh it out the way that I should have. And then it just came down to me wanting to really be known in the streets more so than being known on the court.
You said that you committed robberies to be favored by your friends, peer pressure. You also say it was easy money and that you wanted to be recognized for your criminal involvement. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that.
Right.
Why?
It was just, I believe that at that time, I wanted this image to be a neighborhood favorite. If I had to say a word, I would say a neighborhood favorite hood star, so to speak.
Big man on campus.
Yeah.
Star.
I wanted everybody once at that point in time, my mindset at that point in time was everybody in Hidden Valley, I wanted them to know that was Paul Stroud from the zone two part of the neighborhood.
Do you understand today, looking back on that period of your life and the conversion that you have gone through in your life, do you understand what was missing in your life that filled for you?
Never had that, the CCT type of a family.
What does that mean?
The CCT? Center of Community Transitions type of family. Just being able to have a foundation that could set me into right transition and put me in gear. It was always I had the agency and the opportunity to really pick as what I wanted, mm-hmm. but I never was able to be led into the right direction because I was surrounded by people who were comfortable with what they were at that point in time. And if you're comfortable with where you are, you'll never change.
I'm going to venture to say, even though I've never heard that anybody say I wanted to be recognized for criminal involvement, Eric, I would venture to say that Paul is not alone.
No, Paul is definitely not alone. You have to survive your neighborhood. And part of that is understanding that you have to put the mask on. So if you're in Hidden Valley and you're around gang life, you have to survive that. At the end of the day, you have to survive that. And it brings you certain points of attention and camaraderie and family. Even as morbid as that sounds, what we hope to do is really change that, shift that reference, shift that idea of what family is and really focus on a healthier way of living.
How many people do you work with at any given moment at the Center for Community Transition?
We have classes every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, it's around maybe 15 to 20 new individuals coming through our classes.
Do you feel like you're pushing a stone uphill, or do you feel like you have a handle on it?
We are pushing a stone uphill, but we're pretty strong. We're pretty strong. We could push the stone uphill, but it's a challenge. We know that if an individual is committed to change, if they can sit in our classes, they're going to see the opportunity for change.
You sat in the classes, I take it, Paul.
Yes.
So take me through this, because you get out of prison. It's bewildering. You have trouble transitioning. I believe you said that earlier in this conversation. When you go into the situation at the Center for Community Transitions and you're sitting in these classes, did you buy into it immediately, or was it like, oh, God, I'm here. I'll have to suffer through this. It's not going to help, blah, blah, blah.
You could be honest now.
I would say that initially – I had to see the compassion and the true sincerity of this Center of Community Transition staff, because it's easy for someone to put up a front and be not as genuine.
Mm-hmm.
Like a doctor can prescribe medicine all day. That doesn't mean he sincerely cares about your personal welfare.
Or that he has a good bedside manner.
So,
writing script.
Yeah, so I just – once I was able to really see them pour out their souls into the lessons, and when facilitating, really drilling in and reinstilling what has been taught and questioning and making sure that we grasp it and not just let it be said, but with not getting feedback, but making sure there's an interaction of some sort so that it is hitting home.
I would guess that over the course of working with people for a couple of weeks, it is a slow transition. Does it help the fact that you, Eric, lived that life, that you understand that life, that you understand where they're coming from and what led them into getting into trouble and getting into prison and how it felt to get out of prison? That gives you credibility, obviously. How many people like you are there helping these people in that situation?
There's more. In New York, you see a lot more. I think in North Carolina, with the new peer sports specialist training, there's more individuals entering this field. I actually don't share my story with the class until the second week.
Okay. Why?
I want them to see that my record doesn't define who I am. I define that for myself. Now, many of them will guess by my language and my experience in regards to when I facilitate the classes, but it's not until I tell them about some of the struggles I've had that I actually share that I have a criminal record and how I've let it sometimes become a barrier.
Is that part of what you call building your brand? You help these folks build their brand, and their brand is not, part of that brand is not, oh, I'm an ex-con.
No, not at all. You happen to make some bad choices in life and you have a record, but you're not an ex-con. You're a human being. And that's what's most important.
Does that come as a revelation to these folks? Or that A, that you would say that, or B, that they are?
I think both. I think for many, it's a little shocking when they find out that I have a record. Because again, I don't start the class saying, "Hey, by the way, I'm an ex-con, so I know where you come from." I come and say, "Here, if you want some good information, this is where you're going to get it from."
I would think a lot of the people who find themselves in prison get there because they don't have either the education or the financial wherewithal to support themselves, and so they gravitate toward and they don't have the guidance, as Paul has said, so they gravitate toward something that makes them feel good about themselves and also enables them to eat and sleep someplace that's relatively safe, or at least they can close their eyes for 6 or 8 hours. That's part of the problem you're overcoming when they come to you, right?
That's part of the problem we're working on, yes, is giving them some more stability so they can start building a better life for themselves.
You're working with 30 women in the last 3 years of their sentences. Given our vast population, 30 women does not sound like a lot, is it?
Well, you know, it's like that starfish story. It's one at a time. I'm saving that one that I can get to. It's not a lot. But it is what we do at the women's facility is a long-term process, and so they can be there up to 3 years.
So they're actually sleeping there. They're actually living and sleeping.
Yeah, it's a dormitory.
It's a release program.
Yes.
How do your clients come to you, either at the women's center or the other center? How do you get them? Does the prison system send them to you, or are you picking them off the street? How does it happen?
It's a little bit of both. Most of our clients come through word of mouth from family and friends. They hear about, oh, I just came home. Well, go to CCT or go to Center for Community Transitions LifeWorks program because they'll help you. A lot of them come through the prison system, but most of them come through word of mouth and through agencies.
We're going to come back and talk about precisely what you're doing with these folks in these classes and how it impacted you and how you've turned your life around, Paul. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony, presenting the classic film Singin' in the Rain in full cinematic vision on a giant screen while the orchestra performs the score live tomorrow and Saturday at Belk Theater. Singin' in the Rain info at charlottesymphony.org. And the Iron Yard, existing to create growth and mentorship for people and their ideas through tech-focused education. Enrollment available for 12-week courses dedicated to teaching code and more. Information at theironyard.com/Charlotte. Well, GOP presidential candidates gathered in California for the second debate last night. On the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes, hear morning after analysis of how the candidates fared and the implications for the Republican nomination for president.
Let's say there's a mom-and-pop shop smack dab in the middle of a rapidly gentrifying neighborhood. How are they going to stay relevant?
Gluten-free for your pet. Can you believe that?
Oh, yeah.
It's got no corn or wheat or soy. This is $16.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's all about the gluten-free options, people. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Myra Clark is with us, Executive Director of the Center for Community Transitions. Eric Ortega is the Program Director for LifeWorks. And Paul Stroud is a former client who has turned his life around and is now working with Elevation Church, among other things, and is a mentor for other people. And we'll talk about that as well. We asked on social media, do you think society should do more to help ex-offenders rebuild their lives? Jeremy on Facebook says, yes, without question, we need as many productive members of society as we can get. Recidivism and prisons are too expensive. Ben on Facebook, of course we need to do more to help ex-offenders. The effect of mass incarceration on families and our society is destructive. Rather than investing so much money on the back end of criminal behavior, we should proactively invest tax dollars into our school systems and other social programs to help lessen the negative impact of poverty on our communities. And Justin on Facebook writes, there are tools available. We need to show the community leaders how it is in the best interest and even profitable to help former inmates lead healthy, productive lives. Let's go back to how you help these people. You have 30 women. They stay with you for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Some of them are, they come to you in the final 3 years of their sentence. You're helping them find the education that they need to go in back into society mm-hmm. and to find jobs. And some of them do have jobs. They get out, they go to work, they come back at night, right?
That's exactly right.
How do you do that? These are people who have been in prison for various reasons. What kind of education do they need, and how do you get them jobs?
Well, I think there are quite a few people who need some skill development to get a better job. And there are some women who we see who have a good education, but they can no longer go back to what they were doing before because of the crime that they committed.
So if you committed fraud or something, like maybe you're a bookkeeper mm-hmm. and you're not going to be a bookkeeper again.
No, you're right. Yeah. Embezzlement, you're not going to be handling books. Okay. You'll have to find another line of work.
Okay.
And they really find their own job because we as an organization believe that you need to help yourself. And the women at the facility go through Eric's program and then they get on the phone and start making phone calls and setting appointments. And we do help them get there, but they really have to sell themselves in that job because that's a life skill. If I were to find them a job, then they would be helpless, not necessarily helpless, but not as skilled at finding that job themselves when they get out.
You coach them through the interview technique.
Yes.
And one of the things that you help them, and you have to help them overcome this because the question is going to come up either
yes.
on paper or in person, do you have you ever committed a crime for which you were arrested? They have to say yes to that question, and that could stop the conversation cold and does stop the conversation cold.
Or not even get to the conversation because it's on the application and it gets tossed.
Right. So that becomes the mark of Cain. That becomes the red letter, the scarlet letter that they have to deal with. How do you deal with that? Because that, as I've read some stories in your program, in these mock interviews that you do, they know the question's about to come up and some of them burst into tears because they don't want to have to deal with the question being answered.
It's a challenge. It takes work and patience and really commitment to realizing that your crime doesn't define who you are. It's what you've done. And your accomplishments after those crimes means a lot as well. So we work with them heavily on going through the process of explaining, yes, you've made some bad choices in your life. But let's talk about who you are today. Because an employer is not going to hire that person who committed the crime. They're not going to hire Paul Stroud, who was heavily gang-related. They're not going to hire Eric Ortega, who was hustling and selling drugs. They're not going to hire that person. I wouldn't. They're going to hire the person you are today. And what you have to do as an individual is show that employer who you are.
Well, you have to figure that out for yourself as well. Who are you? Just got out of prison. Who am I? That's a tough question to answer. You are the person that got yourself in trouble, and you are the person who spent X number of months or years in prison. How do you figure that out? How did you figure that out, Paul?
Well, what I really was put into believing from the C Center's Community Transitions classroom was when Mr. Ortega said, he said, your past does not predict your future unless you let it.
Wow.
So when I began to instill that, you know, I am not yesterday. I am today, and I can move forward with my future. It was a mindset. It was new words of life spoken over me, because, you know, to know that it, once you market yourself and brand yourself as what you are now, you can disclose it, but still, you know, what you are as of right now,
right,
and how you've made transition and shifted.
But
that
they,
makes
but they
makes.
Help you get there. It's in your head. You've built this new image of yourself, and it sounds all wonderful. And,
yes.
And then you go on the job interview, and you have to tell somebody, I spent time in prison. And you can probably see it in their face that's the end of that, or that they're passing judgment, or they're even a little afraid. How do you push through that?
I like to follow up with what has been done since the actual crime or offense itself. You have to allow them to see all of your reformation and how you've conformed into the ideal image that you want to be now. And you have to really go in depth and expound on that.
The other thing that strikes me is that for somebody who wanted to be known in the neighborhood for their criminal activity, they want to be the cock of the walk. This is very humbling, it seems to me. You have to humble yourself in front of these people because you have made a mistake, you've paid for your mistake, you're trying to work back into society, and yet, repeatedly, you have to say, I was a bad guy once, and now I've turned my life around. That's very humbling.
Right. There's been times in interviews where I'll say, sir, this is embarrassing, but I've done X, Y, and Z. And they have just realized, like, he says it's embarrassing. So he does not appreciate it. This is not something that he glorifies anymore. You have to let them know you don't glorify. You have to let them know that their lifestyle is no longer on the pedestal and it's non-existent.
How difficult is that for most people, Eric?
It is. It's a real challenge. You're talking about years and years of living a certain way, and that certain lifestyle has helped them survive.
Yeah, because in prison, you got to kind of be you got to put a front up. You got to be the tough guy.
Well, you have to be. Especially when you're not as tall as Paul.
Yes, he is tall.
When you're a short Hispanic guy, you definitely have to worry about it. But no, it's a challenge. You have to. One thing is important. You have to stay true to who you want to be. Through it all, through the adversity, stay true to that.
You teach them how to explain their criminal record,
yes,
to prospective employees or employers. What do you say? I mean, how do you explain that?
Take accountability first. Don't blame it on your cousin Pookie or it's the environment. I made the bad choices. Take accountability for all your wrong choices and let them know. Be transparent with it, because they're going to see it on your criminal record report anyway. But don't leave them in the situation where they're only looking at the negative.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about all the positives you've done while you were incarcerated. Many people don't realize that while an individual is incarcerated, they can go to school. They can work. They choose to work. Because you could spend your time in the hole, as we've seen in popular movies and TV shows. You could just stay and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But you have individuals who go to work, who go back to school, who find ways to be productive while incarcerated. You have individuals who come home from prison and volunteer,
yeah,
and give back. Talk about those changes in your life. So we tell them, be transparent with your record and bring the prospective employer, to where you are today and the accomplishments you're doing.
I don't know whether it's your story or somebody else's, Paul, forgive me, when I was reading a lot about this yesterday, but I think you are one of the people who did volunteer a lot when they got out. Is that right?
Correct, correct.
Are you the person that also said that that's where you find out that you really can make a difference and that it's fulfilling to volunteer?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Just as an e-group leader and a community lead volunteer.
E-group is what?
E-group is an Elevation church-based group,
okay,
as
you.
Well as I have my community group, Guys Advocates. We are all over the place in neon shirts that say Guys Advocates, buttons, the whole nine yards. And when I tell you that being able to take myself out of my problems, so to speak, and really address the issues and the needs of others, it pretty much gave fulfillment, because it took the perspective of self and put it back on the community.
And yes. You are also mentoring young male teens.
Yeah, male teens and athletes.
Do you see yourself in them?
I do, because one of my mentees, he actually talked back to his, he got suspended for talking back to his teacher. So we're now in the process of telling him that his business has to come before his emotion. Like, and I'm relating that to let him know, like, you, school is your business right now, and in the future your money will be your business. So if you're putting these things be before your money, you're going to find yourself in bad places.
Where does that negative emotion about school and the come from? Where does that needing to talk back and not toe the line and not be one of the group come from?
You want to be the class clown. You want to be the big guy. Once again, being that big guy on campus, being known for having a history of, because for they want to be glorified in media and TV. It's always been that teen or that young adult who was just had that spunk and had that bad mouth and was bold enough to come against a grown adult, even being a teenager. They're just seen as like somewhat an ideal image of what it should be at that time in that age bracket.
You start, I believe, your classes by telling the people in the class that you've got to get a new job. Why?
Oh, yeah. Well, in one of the classes we talk about, in my branding class, I give them examples of brands. And one of the examples I give is when CBS owned the Yankees. And during that time, the Yankees really did bad. Uh-huh. And I tell them one of the things that they have to look at is they suck as criminals. If you get caught, you're not good at being a criminal. It's time for a new career. We evaluate careers that way. If you're good at it, then keep on doing it. If you're not, switch careers. So we don't hold punches with our individuals.
You also help them learn how to network with potential employers. And I'm just really curious about that, because it's hard enough for the average person to network with employers, potential employers. How does an ex-prisoner network? Where do you go to do that, to find yourself in that group of people that are potential employers?
We call it at the center hustling the right way. We call it being able to socialize. They're not looking for a job. They're meeting new people. They're meeting new people so people can see their new brand. So networking for us is having conversations. You're not asking for a job. You're asking for somebody to see you who you are.
It's tough to get a job, and that's the biggest – I would think that's the biggest stumbling block. If you get out of prison and you can't get a job, you are going to do something to get money. So I know that your organization, you asked the city of Charlotte to remove the question about previous convictions from the city's job application. Durham did this in 2011, and the city of Charlotte joined what you call the Ban the Box movement as well, because that's a little box on the employment application. Was that largely due to your urging that they did this? And what's been the upshot of it?
Well, two things. I think it gives hope. Let me say what's the benefit of it. It gives hope to individuals coming home to see that there are people in our community who realize that criminal conviction question is discriminatory and does not need to be a part of the process of looking at applications. We are fortunate enough where Myra Clark in 2005 realized that we needed to come together as a community to look at what resources there were for individuals coming home. So she was one of the founding members of what was called at the time MORN, which I know doesn't sound too popular, but it was Mecklenburg Opportunity for Reentry Network, which mm-hmm. is a collaboration of community, private, and correctional agencies coming together to look at how do we help people with reentry. One of the topics we took on was banning the box. We knew that in San Francisco it started from All of Us or None, and we wanted to bring it to North Carolina. We knew that Durham had started it, so we conferred with them and decided how do we come to the city and say, we want you to be our advocates. And they did.
Is it difficult to get employers on board with this? I know you help find job leads for people. Is it difficult for them to sign on?
I think once they hear that the folks that come through our program are willing to work and have a different attitude about that, and they've changed their lives, and we can tell them all the things they've done, I think more employers open the doors. But it is difficult to find employment, and many of our clients here know more than they hear yes, and it's a matter of the more no's you hear, you're getting closer to a yes, and just thinking it through that way. But it is difficult, and I would love to hear from employers who are willing to give people a chance.
Well, Tim on Facebook says we hire lots of people in transition houses simply because they are in the program. So many positives. Less likely to call in sick, less likely to steal, less likely to be confrontational. It is a win-win for us. On the other hand, Fran writes, I have hired halfway house inmates and people on probation. The main problem for me was the way these employees prioritized their family in small ways above their job, missing work to pick up kids repeatedly instead of understanding what consistency and longevity at their job would get them pay increases. How do you handle that?
Well, we have a special program that we created as a collaborative called Working Smart, which is about job retention, and it's about conflict resolution and working out those kinds of things and helping folks stay on the job and find different ways of solving those issues in their lives.
I only have 30 seconds left. Statistically, 2/3 of the people released from prison get rearrested within 3 years. In North Carolina, half are rearrested after 2 years. That's the population at large. What is the recidivism record for people who go through your program?
I think for both of our programs, it's around 87%, 90 percent, somewhere in there.
Did not return.
They stay out.
They stay out.
Yep.
Myra Clark, Executive Director, Eric Ortega, the Program Director of LifeWorks, both with the Center for Community Transitions, and Paul Stroud, who now works at Elevation Church, and also mentors young teen guys and turned himself around. Congratulations to you, and thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our engineer is Joey Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting La Cage aux Folles, a musical comedy in a drag club where a middle-aged gay couple hides their relationship from their son's fiancée and her conservative parents.